I mean,
did she look down and see the building? She was up in the air by herself. I mean, you know. Tell us a little bit about that.
She wasn't by herself. Linda had been having these kinds of experiences since she was very young. And part of the mythology is, how come only people from Nebraska or, you know, from Keokuk or the woods, like they've had these things? Well, forget it. It happens to people in big cities, too. What made this different was that this is lower Manhattan at 2 in the morning, and there's a lot of people up doing things, night jobs, insomniacs, coming and going from, you know, whatever. And once word of this case got out initially, several dozen people contacted Bud. I will say one of the threads that ran through every one of their accounts was, number one, I don't want money. I don't want recognition. I don't want to go on the Oprah show. I don't want to write a book. I am obsessed with what I saw. I have not been the same since. I have to know what happened. Here's my account. Here's a drawing from where I was. But Linda, Swiss Italian, New Yorker, grew up in Little Italy, a very genuine, decent, kind woman who has been married to the same guy for decades, two grown-up sons, two grandsons. But right around Thanksgiving 1989, I was working at the studio, and she came in after having made an appointment with Bud to explore partial memories. And this is also one of the myths that hypnotherapists like Bud are evil, crazy people who think people are abducting people, and they get weak-minded folks. They hypnotize them and convince them that it's happened. The huge majority of folks
evil
have approached Bud over the decades did so because they had at least partial memories of what happened, and they were coming in to make a decision whether or not they should explore them more deeply and what that implied, using hypnosis, regressive hypnosis, in part as a tool. And I watched that whole case move forward in terms of its genesis. The book witnessed the true story of the Brooklyn Bridge UFO abductions. It was published, I believe, in 1996. So that was like a five, almost six-year investigation. And that was a period of time where I worked regularly with Bud, more than any other major case. And that was one that I ate, slept, lived, and breathed on and off for quite a number of years, of course, overlapping most of my work with Larry Warren on the Rendlesham Forest English UFO case. I got to know Linda. She is still a very dear friend. And on that particular instance where the first abduction that they were really exploring came up, she woke up, and I'm working from memory here, so I hope anybody with the book who finds that I'm inaccurate will not accuse me of fabricating or anything like that. But as I recall, she levitated off her bed. There were gray beings in the room. She was in her nightgown. It's November, rather cold. And she and they float through the plate glass bedroom window of her 12th floor apartment in Lower Manhattan, obviously very close to the Brooklyn Bridge, and up into a huge glowing disc, which was seen by many people, most of whom, once they, you know, got over not believing their eyes, assumed it was some kind of extraordinary special effect and that a movie was being shot in Lower Manhattan. And for me, as an investigative writer who approaches things in a very pragmatic way, I can't tell you how exciting it was over the months when we really started to receive these accounts from people who, to the best of our knowledge, did not know each other. And again, very important, because the first thing the critical or debunking mind is going to say, well, they're in it for something. In this case, no one, and I stress again, nobody wanted a cent. Nobody wanted any recognition. A number of people who came forward were so upset that they said, I'm going to give you my account, but you can't even include me in the book. And I don't know, there's like two dozen or so people, real people. Woman coming back from a friend's retirement party on the Brooklyn Bridge looks and sees what she assumes is a film being shot. somebody down at the loading dock of one of the big New York City papers, blue collar, looks up and sees this woman in a nightgown and these three kind of curled up things floating into this huge disc. Then the story gets very complicated, but all through it, Linda remained Linda. And when Bud finally sat her down and told her that upon genuine deep investigation, that it really did seem that this had happened to her in no uncertain terms, when what she was hoping for was that he could help her establish that she was suffering from some kind of hallucinatory condition or mental aberration and refer her to the right kind of medical professional to give her some kind of prescription to make it go away, she was heartbroken. And something I was pledged not to speak to about for many years, but she has now made it public, and it was wonderful hearing her talk about it, was at the time Cardinal O'Connor, certainly one of the most powerful and best-known Catholic prelates in America. He was associated with St. Patrick's Cathedral. He is, again, a ranking American cardinal in New York City. He requested, well, Linda wanted to meet with him, and he made it very clear that that was just fine with him. And they met a number of times. He didn't seem, you know, he didn't tell her she was crazy or anything or going to hell. He was fascinated by it, and they developed a rather extraordinary rapport. There are many other parts of the story, but it's the real deal. It happens, and it happens to real people. Although, of course, the logical mind, especially folks not like you guys or me who have studied this subject coming out of our original interest in the UFO phenomena per se, you know, we're faced with the data. And I think part of our job is, as my sister kind of set the example for me, is to help educate people. And one of the things that I really love about what you do, Jerry, is you're a broadcaster. You know, you could be covering lots of other topics and all kinds of goofy things that people are interested in, more superficial. But you've dedicated your professional life to this. Elaine's been an activist. Is it Greg? Also Greg. Out there in the field trying to make sense of this and help people understand in, you know, our own ways that this is not, you know, our little fantasy. This is something that is really going on.
Yeah, Peter, I understand you have to go here pretty quickly, but before you do, you've got to set up a date with me to tell me the latest on Rendlesham. When you get back home, if you ever get back home.
Major, I think. Yeah. Let's speak in the next week or so, because also I haven't even touched on, this has been an amazing couple of months for me. Here I am in beautiful Arizona, working with some great people, and last month, I spent most of the month abroad. I spoke in three different cities in France. I did four television shows there. I spoke at the big Rendlesham Forest Conference, and I even had my very first opportunity to head out to the mysterious, beautiful part of England known as Wiltshire, which is crop circle country, and through my dear friend and colleague Jennifer Stein, who is one of the most knowledgeable people in America on crop circles and a very rational researcher. We spent the day visiting three different formations with one of the great local authorities, and I'll tell you what, it was one of the most exciting days I've had in years. Fascinating. So, yeah, plenty to talk about on the next show for sure.
Yeah, we're going to have to. Elaine and Craig, you have any parting comments or questions?
I have some questions for Peter.
Sure.
My understanding is that there's a lot more to the story than we know from Witness. A lot more broke after Witness was published. Is that correct?
Not so much that I'm aware of. After it was published?
Not really. Because there are several things that I understood about is that the Dave and Dan saga was that it turns out that they were involved in, it was like an official motorcade or something like that.
Everything that I'm aware of, with the exception of, I guess, the odd little postscript, is in that book, fully investigated and published. Yeah. I would say, for anybody that's listening and you're new to the subject, if you're interested in reading a book on UFO abduction phenomena as opposed to UFOs per se, I think this is as great a book on a single case, and it is certainly the most important book ever published on a multiple witness case.
It reads like a really good detective
case.
Novel.
They can pick that book up. Peter, what's the correct title of that book?
It's Witnessed, The True Story of the Brooklyn Bridge UFO Abductions. And I would also say that, like really most of Bud's books, you can find these books, either a good reader copy or a collector copy, used online. You don't have to, get a brand new book. It's the content that you're after. And it was published in hardcover as well as a mass market paperback, as were Bud's other books. And, build your library for me as a bibliophile and a avid reader. I would also say, if you want to read one of the most unique memoirs that I'm aware of ever published in this country, the book that Bud finished 2 years before he died, well, 3 years before he died, is a book called Art, Life, and UFOs. And it's a memoir about Bud's art, about his life, and about his interest and involvement with UFOs. And it's a heck of a unique American story. He was quite a guy and a very fine writer, and he pulls no punches in the book. It's quite something.
And Elaine, you've had experiences with the late, great Bud Hopkins as well. You have any closing comments?
Peter, you're very well spoken.
Thanks. I have somebody. I pay a lot of money to write my scripts for me.
Thanks, okay, Elaine. We're going to take a break. Computer will...
That's a real compliment, and I appreciate it. And I appreciate all of your hard work over the years as well.
We have Stan Romanek standing by. Interesting fellow and an interesting experience. Scary, really. That's coming up as we continue with our abduction special on Jerry Pippin. Don't go away. You know, when we pause for a commercial, it's always for somebody who pays the freight, pays the way. Well, I'm going to take time out to talk about somebody who can't pay their way. And that's the stray animals, dogs and cats and other animals, who need your help. And there is a way to help them. Support no-kill animal shelters. It's a gift of life that keeps on giving. These animal shelters are located around the world and maybe in your neighborhood. Animals, they need love. They don't need to be sent someplace and then executed just because they don't have a home. Support the animal shelter that is a no-kill shelter near you. Give them a donation of $10, $25, $50 or more. The money will be well used. The animals will love you for it. So give a gift of love, a gift of life, to that stray dog or cat. Our ET abduction special continues. Many times, they come in the middle of the night. Terror, the fear, is overriding. Those who experience it never forget it.
When I opened up my eyes before I threw that pillow, this thing was standing at the foot of my bed. Do you know what that's like? How did that thing get in my apartment? And it was standing there, just standing there staring at me. These people took me. And they were your classic grays, you know, with the large heads and the big black shiny eyes. I don't remember a nose, but they had slits for mouths, long necks, real thin. They were about my size at the time, maybe taller.
And this is our abduction special for the middle of the summer, July 25th, is when the broadcast is live. And we have on our panel Elaine Douglas, and she, of course, has the Abduction Magazine Jars, which is a quarterly email, e-mag, I guess is what we like to call it. And then we have Craig Lang, who's a hypnotherapist really for 15 years or so, and active in MUFON as well. And in a minute, we're going to, you just heard that little bumper, as we call it in the business, and it was actually a woman testifying and some other people about their abduction experiences. And in a moment, we're going to have Stan Romanek, who has become quite well known, and he's had an incredible experience, terrifying in many ways. And I'm not trying to put words in his mouth. We'll let him describe it himself. But before we go to Stan out there in Colorado, Elaine, we kind of had you, you were kind of quiet during the last 15 or 20 minutes, so I thought I'd give you a chance to add anything to the show so far, if you feel up to it.
Well, I had a, it was very enjoyable listening to Peter.
Yeah, he mentioned something when we were talking to Peter Robinson, talking about his time that he worked with Bud Hopkins. One thing that kind of went by us, but as an editor of JARS, the magazine, a lot of these experiences have had UFO sightings, but not always. I've always found that puzzling. Maybe
no,
they just
correct.
Don't remember it.
That's correct. Not all abductees have had a UFO sighting.
And so it's a little tough. Craig, you had a lot of questions for Peter, and we didn't have enough time to really go through all of them. You have anything to say before we get to Stan?
The comment or question or whatever that I had, I know several people who have done some independent digging on the whole Brooklyn Bridge abductions thing, and there's a lot of other writings and investigative notes outside of what Bud Hopkins wrote. And I don't know that much about it, you know, frankly. I have not followed the case that closely.
What are your questions? What's one of your questions that you have?
That's where I'm headed. Is that was there, that apparently there was some more that had happened in that apparently Linda's relationship with Cardinal O'Connor was, who initiated that and things like that. I'm just really curious about the truth behind some of that.
Well, you've probably heard that Linda had many run-ins with either intelligence officers or police.
Yeah, right.
Picked her up for interrogations and
yeah.
things like that and got very involved in her case. Plus, of course,
yeah.
the big deal is that somebody named Cuellar, a UN official, was ostensibly parked under a nearby bridge and witnessed with him and his bodyguards.
Yeah, Perez de Cuellar, yeah, right. He was Secretary
yeah.
General at the time.
Right, so the case, you know, is it's quite a deal. It's quite
well,
a deal.
As Stan Romanek will tell us here in a moment, when you come out and make public statements like this, there's always people taking pot shots at you.
Yeah, right.
And Linda is not without some of those, including Bud's ex-wife. But at the same time, I'm inclined to take people at their word and at what they say, unless proven otherwise. I think it's much easier to have an open mind than it is to be a skeptic from the beginning. And Stan Romanek's story got me going a long time ago, and I couldn't track him down for some reason, but I found several people who knew him. In fact, did a show, and broadcasters are famous for this. I did a show with people who knew him because I couldn't find Stan at the time. But we found him tonight. And Stan, how are you?
I'm good. I'm doing really good.
Good, good. So you had a little tragedy there, and we all are familiar with, but it kind of hit personally there in Aurora. One of your friends was shot, right?
Exactly. Our close friend Heidi, her daughter was at the movie theater when the gunman came and started opening fire, and she wasn't actually shot. She was hit by shrapnel from, apparently what happened is this crazy guy took pieces of metal and all kinds of other stuff and taped it around this smoke grenade, so when the smoke grenade went off, it acted as a regular grenade, and it literally opened her up like a gutted fish, and luckily she, you know, there were people there to save her and, you know, get her to the hospital right away,
uh-huh.
But she's still in critical condition.
Well, let's hope for the best, and I'm sure all of our positive vibes are going that way for all of those people involved in that. Let's get to the subject at hand for a minute, Stan, and maybe you can tell people exactly from the beginning a little bit about your experiences. When did this start happening?
Well, the main part of my experiences really started with my very first UFO sighting in 2000. But it goes back, like most experiencers, my story goes back to when I was a child. My father was involved in the military. He was in the Air Force. He had top secret clearance and worked at missile bases with ICBM missiles. And there's a story in my family that's been there since 68. I was 5 years old at the time, and my father was stationed at Grand Forks and worked between Grand Forks and Minot, North Dakota, at the missile bases there.
Mm-hmm.
And they had an incident where a UFO came down and armed one of the missiles. Not disarmed, but armed the missile in launch position. And, you know, there's some things that happened after that I remember as a small child, a very strange woman that kind of followed me throughout my life. And then in 2000, when I saw my first UFO, it just kind of kick-started everything from there. And then 2001, I had my first abduction, and everything went crazy.
Well, let's talk a little bit about that first abduction that you can remember. Were you aware of being abducted originally, or?
Absolutely. You know, when you watch television, you know, they always try to get people to think that it's this thing called sleep paralysis. But the trouble with that scenario, number one, sleep paralysis is fairly rare. You almost have to be narcoleptic to have it. Number two, it doesn't account for, you know, cases like Betty and Barney Hill, Travis Walton, Snowflake, Arizona. In my case, I was completely awake when it happened. I wasn't asleep at all. In fact, I remembered most everything. Funny thing is, when you get that traumatized, you convince yourself that it's something other than it is. And I convinced myself it was some kind of bizarre nightmare. Until I got up the next morning and there was all kinds of evidence. And then my world came crashing down rather quickly.
Yeah, now tell our audience a little bit about, you said traumatized, so it wasn't a pleasant experience.
Well, it wasn't, you know, with anything that is, you know, where society forces us to, you know, only believe in certain things, and believing in UFOs and aliens is not one of them, at least not for me. I was a complete skeptic. And when my experiences happened, it was very, very hard for me to come to terms with that. I mean, I've got this theory. There are two different types of reality. There's the reality that we were taught by society, and then there's the true reality that is more amazing than we could ever imagine. And getting to that second reality is pretty tough for a lot of people. And yes, my experiences were scary in the fact that I was dealing with beings that were not from this planet. Were they as horrible as some? No. You hear all kinds of horrible stories about the abduction experience. Yes, they took me against my will. Yes, they did experiments on me, but they seemed to, whoever these particular beings were, seem to be very concerned about my mental health, about my, you know, they didn't want me to be in pain. They didn't want me to, you know, which sometimes you hear. You know, I've heard different scenarios. So to me, it seems like there must be different things here with different agendas. Some just don't care and some do.
Now, when you talk about the dead things to your experiments, what kind of things?
Well, when I was taken, I was literally woken up in the middle of the actually, it was about 2 o'clock in the morning, and there was a knock at the door, which is not typical of the abduction phenomena. And there were 3 beings at the door that I thought were small. Yeah, I thought they were just teenagers messing around until I got close and realized that, no, they weren't masks, no, they weren't costumes. And, you know, the experiments are...
I mean, were they grays?
They weren't. They weren't your typical aliens that you see on TV. They weren't the typical grays. They had very big heads, like grays do. They were a little bit taller. They were maybe 4 foot some odd inches. Very, very pale, but not gray. And they had hair, but the hair was almost pure white and very sparse. And their eyes were not all black. They had irises, and their irises, and very huge wraparound, very slanted eyes. But their irises were so blue, they were almost violet. And I remember the only name I could come up with was possum people, because they have these very long, and even that's not correct, but they have this very long kind of pointy chin and a very small mouth and nose at the end of this, you know, toward the end of this chin. And I remember the way they moved was completely different, too. They were very, how do I explain it? They weren't jerky at all. They were very smooth in their movements. Like they were able to control their movements a lot better than, and very quick also. But
did they say anything?
They, not like you or I, and it's very hard for me to explain, because it's almost like trying to explain the color red to somebody that's blind and somebody that's never seen the color red before, but. You know, it's like a thought would pop into your head, and that's when I realized that, yeah, that's how they communicated.
So they were there at the door. Did they carry you out,
the
command that you go with them, or they come in, or
well,
what?
Well, that's the thing about this whole situation. Oddly, I was screaming internally because I was terrified that no sound would come out of my mouth. My sister had already opened the door, and there were these people standing outside, and the one in the middle came in, and we lived in a second-story apartment, came in and grabbed my wrist, and they started leading me out to the balcony. And right as we got to the slide,